Please be seated. The next case on the en banc argument is case number 62444, Eugene Ross v. State. You're ready to proceed, counsel?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Good morning, Justices. My name is David Kleber. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Eugene Ross. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal. That a defendant is constitutionally entitled to a fair trial goes without saying. But before the jury received any evidence, through the end of these proceedings, the trial court engaged in such a confusing, chaotic, and at times bizarre application of acceptable precepts of fairness, including making the required findings, that it cannot be said with any confidence that Mr. Ross got a fair trial, and a review of all the issues certainly warrants a reversal of his conviction. The facts of this matter reveal a largely circumstantial case, but explainable way, against Mr. Ross, that but for the errors, there can be no confidence that the verdict would have been the same. I would like to emphasize three primary issues of concern, and they are, number one, the court's prevention of evidence being given to the jury in the form of the co-defendant's admissions, which were exculpatory for Mr. Ross. Number two, the court's refusal to grant mistrial or strike jurors after four separate, remarkable incidences which required the stoppage of the proceedings to canvass some or all of the jurors, and three, the state's systemic destruction of impeachment evidence and the court's refusal to grant any relief given the admitted destruction of evidence in the form of witness payments. As to the first issue, the exclusion of the admissions of the co-defendant, Casey Coulter. It is vital to understand before addressing that, the timing of the exclusion, as well as the court's failure to allow Mr. Ross to even make a record. Prior to being charged with any offense, Mr. Coulter reached out to defense counsel with the desire to give information about this very case. In that letter, Mr. Coulter indicated not only an intimate knowledge of the facts surrounding the offense, he also put himself in possession of the white Cadillac used in the offense and the contents used for the offense, which included the gloves, duct tape, and murder weapon at the obvious time of the offense. Shortly thereafter, an investigator from the defense followed up with Mr. Coulter, and ultimately an affidavit was produced, which was signed and adopted by Mr. Coulter. That was in 2006. That information was timely presented to all the parties shortly thereafter. It was not until 2012, at trial, in the middle of Mr. Ross's opening argument, that the co-defendant, but not the state, objected to its admission. The defense was completely surprised by this attack on his absolute right for a meaningful opportunity to present a complete defense. Everyone, the co-defendant, the court, and the state, were aware of the existence of this evidence, and its desirability for introduction by Mr. Ross was evident. As evident as the reason we asked for a new trial when Mr. Coulter, after the verdicts were given, gave a full confession. There were a number of reasons why Mr. Ross was trying to introduce the evidence, and it was obviously material. There was, however, a non-hearsay point that was made, or attempted to be made, but the court would not allow the defense to make a further record or to bring in any witnesses. But just for the record, the main non-hearsay point about the co-defendant's admissions was that the two, Mr. Ross and Mr. Coulter, were friends, and that Mr. Coulter's actions created a circumstantial case where Mr. Ross, completely innocent of the charges, was implicated. That just by reaching out and explaining the situation, whether or not the jury were to believe those words, it explained that Mr. Coulter regretted implicating an innocent man who wasn't there. It answered the burning question of the jury's mind that these two were such good friends that Mr. Ross would trust him with his car, gun, and possession, then why wouldn't Mr. Coulter reach out after his buddy was wrongfully arrested? But he did reach out, only the jury never got that information to evaluate because of the last minute in the opening statement's objection of the co-defendant, which was ultimately joined in by the state.
And that was part and parcel of his theory of his defense.
It was completely the critical and central part of the theory of defense was that he had loaned all these things to his friend, and then his friend had called me after, which brought him over to near the scene, but not at the scene, where he was then handed the car keys, which would explain for, again, the circumstantial evidence being explained away the gunshot residue transfer, which the state's own expert said was a likely event in transference of gunshot residue. We aver that it was an abuse of discretion at the time of its exclusion because the trial court did not have a record, and the hurried nature of this argument disallowed a thoughtful analysis and looked more like an arbitrary and capricious decision which went to the core of the defense's theory. If admitted, it certainly would have allowed the jury to hear that Mr. Ross was not present with Mr. Coulter at the material times during the murder and explained again why he was a mile away. Moving on to issue number two, the jury issues. It may be unprecedented for this court to have seen so many juror-related issues in one case. We aver that all four independent separate incidents involving some or all of the jurors were independently grounds for a reversal, since the district court never determined on the record that there was no effect on the jury verdict or no prejudice beyond a reasonable doubt pursuant to the Rover decision that this court held. Indeed, no findings at all on the record, no accord even of the incident where the jurors gave wildly different accounts and one juror actually accused another juror of having bias. There was a juror being held in contempt and sanctioned for saying she could not be fair that the other jurors heard about. A juror allegedly talking to mystery men about the case in a bar, but other jurors saying when he discussed it with them, he said he had heard something he shouldn't have heard in an elevator. Jurors complaining about speeding things up. And the young male juror who went home to the defendant's mother who was trying to procure our defense witness and then getting his new iPhone confiscated. For the sake of time, that's not all the issues related to the jury, but the rest are outlined in our briefs. Time and again, though, the point is the defense was asking for relief, either to remove the tainted juror or to remove the panel, and it was always denied. The case of juror number one is probably the most egregious, although the conversation of juror number 12, which was contradicted by juror number two, is also of note. But juror number one interacted with the defendant's mother by loaning her his new iPhone. He heard her desperate pleas to get a defense witness to come testify. He said it was so loud that everyone heard. He knew the person he gave the phone to was someone he saw in the courtroom and that it was likely one of the defendant's relatives. We know that that phone call lasted for 2 minutes and it appears that it was a defense witness on the phone and this defense witness was either indifferent or reluctant to come to court. That witness did testify and turned out to be the defense's only alibi witness. Then he got his phone confiscated not for a day, but for many days. And coming between a young man and his new iPhone who was just back from Afghanistan, I would suggest is the equivalent of grounding a teenager and taking away their most prized possession. The fact that he might have said he could still be fair, I think the conversation he had with the court reveals that he was anything but happy about the situation and certainly held some sort of animus towards the people who got him into this mess when, in fact, as a juror, he should have known better than to interact with someone he knew from the courtroom. Finally, issue three, and I will just leave it at this before I reserve the rest of my time. As the court is undoubtedly aware, the issue of what records the district attorney retains or doesn't retain has been at the center of great discourse in our community since this case was initially briefed. As I understand it, many aspects of what the DA does and refuses to do and has possibly misrepresented what it does is still an issue up in the air, but it's not part of this record yet. The record in this case, however, as it presently suggests, is basically undisputed. The state concedes that the records which were requested, the records which we believe are exculpatory because they are impeachment evidence, were in fact destroyed. It cannot be argued that they were not exculpatory.
Counsel, that's that issue. Weren't part of the records produced? There were parts destroyed, and didn't the defense extrapolate in terms of the other payments that were made?
You're correct, Justice Douglas, that some records were produced and others were said to be destroyed. It was the state's suggestion that we could extrapolate, but
wasn't it done?
It was not done because we could extrapolate purely the witness appearance fees.
Did you ask a question about, I think the testimony was, were you paid every time you went to the district attorney's office? And the response was yes.
Correct. And so to the extent that it was solely based on the unauthorized, and we would suggest...
So the primary thing was the jury was aware that the witness was getting paid.
some payments, but they didn't know what that was. And it was certainly limited to the interaction of these unauthorized and, I would suggest, unlawful appearances in the prosecutor's office to get paid to discuss the testimony. What other records are out there? What other
need to discuss the testimony or...
Well, I mean, they are called to their private office. It's not a court appearance by any stretch of the imagination. I know they suggest that in their brief, but it is not a court appearance, nor should it be determined to be a court appearance.
Could you walk us back through point one, because you kind of ran over that real quickly in terms of the letter and the affidavit, and I guess it's two parts in terms of what was in it and also potential credibility of the witness. A relationship with the witness?
Certainly, Your Honor. It really is about the timing and the manner of being able to present issues on it. It certainly shouldn't have happened there, and even the trial court judge later admitted in the motion for new trial that this should have happened well before the time that it did. So we were at a very great disadvantage. As far as the materiality of it, we feel that it's evident that in the letter and or the affidavit, certain information would have been conveyed to the jury. Some of that was non-hearsay. The non-hearsay part was that these two were friends, that he put his friend in a bind and did reach out. That the mere act of reaching out to someone to try to explain that his buddy is in a bad jam because of his actions also supports a lot of things. It explains the relationship between the two, that they had a friendship, that it would be reasonable for Mr. Ross to have rent all these things, his car, etc. We also had corroboration that this happened before. It just wasn't as strong as what was present in the letter and the affidavit. We had a ticket, which we were able to introduce to the jury, that showed that Mr. Coulter had received a traffic citation while driving Mr. Ross's car at an unrelated time. So that was why it was somewhat tenuous, but it was definitely corroborative. So it did exist. I mean, there were a lot of reasons for it. Certainly he did make some admissions in there that would have been sufficient to expose him to criminal liability. That is of interesting, but it is not the dispositive part because there were non-hearsay aspects to the statements as well. However, with regard to that, Mr. Coulter had not yet been arrested when he made those statements. And what was testified at trial is that the Metropolitan Police Department was looking at Mr. Coulter because they knew that his wallet was in the car, and that was sufficient for them to get probable cause. So I think it would be disingenuous to say that he didn't make some admissions that put him far greater into the mix, and there was certainly no benefit for him. So there were a lot of reasons, but again, that should have been fleshed out far before opening statements.
Mr. Finger, just if you would, very briefly, would you discuss the affidavit and the reason the judge excluded that affidavit? And I'm not quite sure I understand the entire basis, whether it was that the affidavit was not trustworthy or that it differed from the letter. And the affidavit was apparently based upon the letter that he wrote, correct?
And that is the problem with the record, Your Honor, and the way that it was made. It doesn't reflect that. I know that the respondent has attempted to fashion it as being an exercise because of its trustworthiness or its reliability solely. That would relate to the penal interest component of the hearsay rules, but that isn't said. You could go through that record. She never says untrustworthy. She never says unreliable. She says only, I've always had grave concerns about this affidavit. She doesn't articulate what those grave concerns were. And then at the end she says, I just don't think that it should come in. She does not give a reason. She doesn't do the findings that this court would be able to.
When you say she,
I'm sorry, the trial court judge.
I think it's best to characterize.
And I apologize both to the court and to the trial court judge.
My other question to you, just briefly, you mentioned the gunshot residue on his hands and that it was transferred from the keys. Was that what, I just want to hear a little more from that and what the significance of that was in the scope of this trial.
Well, the prosecution relies on a very, what they say is a scientific case. We were able to explain away much of the scientific case, if not all of them, and I believe all. One was, well, how does gunshot residue show up on the hands of someone who wasn't in there? Well, what isn't on Mr. Ross? There's no blood on him. There's nothing from that small room where a man was shot 19 times. There's nothing that indicates that he was in the room There is gunshot, dots of gunshot residue on his hand, and during the demonstration of the expert, state's expert witness, she indicated that there were numerous ways that it could be transferred and agreed that if somebody who had just shot 19 times had a lot of gunshot residue on him, handing an item to someone who had not shot anyone could result in the small transfer that we did witness.
So it was a very small amount of gunshot residue on his hand.
It was inordinately small amount. It was a minuscule amount. It was micro dots.
That answers my question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Piper. Good morning.
Yeah. Counsel, could you maybe answer? I know you've got a lot of issues to talk about here. The first one over on this affidavit in the letter here, Mr. Figler saying the judge never really ruled instead set forth a basis for why it wasn't being admitted. And it seems to me, looking at it, it would be admissible. It's against the penal interest, and it's part of their theory of defense here. So can you maybe clarify, I know it's an abuse of discretion issue, but what the state's position is on that?
Sure. Danielle Piper on behalf of the respondent. I think while I disagree with the court's analysis, in the state's opinion, it is not a statement against interest. When you read the letter and then you read the affidavit attached to it, the letter talks a lot about how Casey Coulter picks up the car the night before. And then the morning of, he's with these two people, J-Bone and Teaspoon. They then are then driving around sort of the strip area. The next morning, there's no address given as to where the car ends up, but they talk about how Casey Coulter talks about how he's sitting in a car, and J-Bone and Teaspoon then go up into an apartment. We don't know the location of the address. We don't even know the time that he's talking about. He then, Casey Coulter in his letter, talks about how he goes up into that apartment and something bad is happening, and then he gets in the car and he takes off. You read the affidavit is something similar. It talks about dates and sometimes, but it doesn't necessarily narrow it down to the time of the murder. There's no address to say, hey, it happened at 3425 Bruce. There's no admission of him saying, I committed this crime, my friend did not. It actually, when you read the entirety of it, he sort of kind of puts himself near it, but he distances himself. He clearly is trying to exculpate appellant. But I think when you look at the Chambers case, which is what appellant cited, the Chambers case is different. Chambers talks about the fact that Chambers was charged with the crime of shooting a police officer. And then somebody by the name of McDonald had actually confessed to two people, and then McDonald had actually said to another person, hey, can you come with me to get a .22 caliber gun because I got rid of mine after I shot this police officer. The .22 caliber gun is important because that is what was used in the killing of this police officer. The court in Mississippi, because of the idiosyncratic ways that their hearsay laws work, basically said, we're not going to allow that evidence in because in Mississippi, I guess you can vouch for your witnesses, and you're not allowed to impeach your own witnesses. The evidence in the Chambers case was corroborated, and it was reliable. The evidence in this case, the affidavit and the letter, was not. He's not admitting that he committed a crime. He's saying, I'm in the area. I had the car, but he's not saying I committed the crime. The statement is not against his interest. If the case had been severed, if Eugene Ross and Casey Coulter were tried separately, that affidavit and that letter would not have been admissible. It would not have come in against them separately. So while I understand that counsel is saying that the court may not have made the best record, one of the things I think that you look at when you look at these arguments is the arguments co-defendant was making, Casey Coulter, and then obviously that the state was making, that it's not a statement against interests. That while he is unavailable, because obviously he invoked his Fifth Amendment right, it's not a statement against interests. And counsel or appellant argued at the trial court that it was a res justi. Well, res justi is it tells the complete story. That's not really a complete story in regard to the murder. It may explain the car, but where the car is and where Eugene Ross was located, they're miles apart. It's not as if the car, where the car was found by police and where Eugene Ross was found was maybe two blocks away. They're miles apart from each other. So essentially, Coulter is saying the car is in one place, but he never gives us a location. And then he says he met up with appellant in another location.
Was there ever any discussion about severing these trials of these two, Coulter and Mr. Ross?
But you mean in front of the trial court?
Yeah.
Yes, there were numerous motions made by appellant's counsel after the initial opening statements when it wasn't admitted, and then different times throughout the trials, he argued for severance. And most of it was based on this affidavit and letter. The state would submit to this court that that information would not have come in a severed trial.
If it were severed,
yes.
If the judge, then the defense could have called Kohler as a witness, put him on the stand, and he'd have to either answer the question or take the Fifth Amendment on the stand in front of the jury.
That's the right to do that. That is true. However, in this trial, he invoked. And he could have done that, you're right. Mm-hmm. But essentially, the letter and the affidavit itself would not have come in. They would have had to have called him, and obviously he could have invoked in front of the jury. Okay. So our position is that it wouldn't have come in a severed trial. You could look at these two defendants in trial, and you can believe, based or the jury could have believed, that essentially because that information couldn't come in, they didn't need to essentially find them both guilty. Because Coulter's defense was essentially, I wasn't there. Now his defense attorney said, Eugene Ross was. And Eugene Ross's defense was, I wasn't there at all. I didn't have anything to do with this.
Well, didn't he in his affidavit, I'm going back to Coulter's affidavit, indicate somewhere in there that, yes, he was wearing a red beanie and he had clothes descriptive of what was identified at the scene? I believe it was number 19, paragraph 19 of his affidavit, dated January, let's see, no, I can't see that one. I'm getting old, my eyes are getting bad.
Is it the, there's two
affidavits. Yeah,
I count them as two letters in this case because both of them are fairly lengthy. And the affidavit, which I'm looking at.
This is, it says page 1 of 7, affidavit of Casey Coulter. I cannot read what's on something about being a date of birth, January 18, 1978. Anyway, my point is I'm going back against some of these aspects that are against potentially his penal interest,
okay.
Making inculpatory statements that arguably could be against his penal interest and cause us to come in. And considering, as I had mentioned earlier, that this could have been an important aspect of Mr. Ross's theory of the case, it's a little bothersome.
And I can understand that it's bothersome. And Casey Coulter, in his first letter, essentially says he's sitting in the car and then he walks up to the apartment and at that point he sees something bad happening, so then he leaves. He gets in the car and he leaves. Maybe he admitted then that his beanie was there and his beanie's at the scene, and then it's a mere presence, right? Then at that point, Casey Coulter may be arguing later if we charge him with the crime, I'm merely present. But my point, I guess, is that when you look at them together, when you look at, let me be clear, when you look at the affidavit that he did when he was first in custody, unrepresented by counsel, when you look at that affidavit, that letter, and then you look at the affidavit, so the pretrial stuff, when you look at those two things, either together or separate, in the state's opinion, there is no statement against interest. He's not admitting to anything. There's nothing in there that you look at him that would subject him to criminal charges. Because he never says, I'm at the scene committing the murder. He says he's maybe near, but then he's blaming two other people for being there. That he's there because they put him there. That he's in the car while they're committing this crime, and when he goes up the stairs, that he sees something bad happen. He never admits to anything. He admits to being near, but we don't even have an address in regard to where this car is. We don't have an address that, hey, I was at the La Rochelle Apartments, which is where the murder took place, and then I was later near the scene where the car was, or I was near where Mr. Ross was miles away. There is no statement against interest, which when you look at 51.345, that's what it talks about. It tended to subject the declarant to civil or criminal liability. None of those things in the affidavit and the letter would have subjected him to that.
Thank you.
Did anybody else have a question for me in regard to the affidavit?
Apparently not.
I guess I can address counsel's. Let me go back really quickly. You know, one of the things I think, Justice Perry-Gerry, that you talked about was that the defense's theory of the case or appellant's theory of the case may have been curtailed. I'm not using your words, I'm using mine.
Right.
And I think when you look at this case as a whole, it wasn't curtailed. The information that essentially, some of the information that essentially was in the letter and again was in the affidavit came out. One, through Tony Reed's testimony. She testified about getting the car, about, you know, hearing about Ross looking for his car, about the fact that, you know, Casey Coulter had it. That came out. And then the defendant got up and essentially said what was in the letter and was what was in the affidavit. So it's not as if it never came out and they were completely precluded from that information coming out.
So the exculpatory statements that were contained in the letter and the affidavit did come out during trial?
Yes. The fact that the car, that their theory was at the time that the crime was committed, he did not have the car.
I'm talking about the absolute statements that he didn't do this.
He got up and said he didn't do this. Mm-hmm. But in the affidavit, when I read the affidavit, it says that Ross didn't do that, but it never says, Casey Coulter never says, I committed the crime. That's how I know he did not. It's subtle, I don't know.
That makes sense.
The juror misconduct in this case, I think the way it's been characterized isn't correct or exact. A lot of odd things happen in this case. In regard to juror number one, defendant's mother approached her, I think, from watching the demeanor of the juror and what he said. He felt really bad. He felt uncomfortable, but he wasn't sure what to do when somebody who was sitting in the courtroom, and he even talked about the fact that, I don't know if she sort of with the prosecution or the defense, because she sat on different sides of the courtroom during the proceedings. He felt uncomfortable just saying no to her. I think the fact that the district court judge kept the phone is unusual. But the reason the district court judge kept the phone was because while we were having a hearing, after defendant or appellant's mother used the phone rang, and the witness called back. And I think when the witness called the juror's phone, the district court at that point felt uncomfortable with giving the juror back his phone.
But not uncomfortable enough to get rid of the juror?
Well, what she did was she
canvassed. Get rid of the phone, but not the juror.
What she did was she canvassed the juror, and she talked to the juror. And I think, well, it is an unusual circumstance. I have never had that circumstance happen.
45 years, I've never, I couldn't imagine it happening, personally.
It didn't happen so often.
That's true.
I'm not going to comment on that. I think it's unusual, but I think it's also unusual that the appellant's mother had just spoken with appellant's counsel. They had told her, we had already reached out to Tony Reed, we left her a number, let it go. And instead of just waiting, appellant's mother approached this juror.
Now, you had alternates, right? There were alternates, right?
We did.
That's why we have alternates, for this exact reason.
That is true. But I think in this case, one of the things that we do is we take the jury process very seriously. We also listen to jurors. That juror could have said, you know what, I want my phone back. Yeah, I can't be fair and impartial. Because he had seen other jurors get dismissed. He saw, you know, essentially Willie Smith had an outburst in the middle of the courtroom, and he saw that she was able to leave. He may not have known about the contempt fine, but he knew she was able to leave. He had other options, but I think at that point he was being honest. He felt bad about what he did because he felt like, oh, no, I put this trial in a bad situation because I let somebody borrow my phone instead of going, hey, that lady probably shouldn't have come up to me because I don't know who she is, but she knows who I am.
Well, and that begs a question, but out of curiosity, I'd like to know how it occurred, if it did in fact occur the way I understand it, that the judge, in fact, tried to call back the number that No?
No, what happened was once the judge was alerted to it, the judge had her marshal take the phone. She was then in court. What happened was Mr. Buning walked up and said, "Judge, let me, for the record, make a clear record about what happened." Mr. Buning then explained that he had tried to call this witness probably about 5 seconds prior to the appellant's mother going up to the jury. He said, "I tried to call the witness. She didn't answer. I left a message." Mr. Buning then explained to the court, "I had spoken to this witness the night before. She said she's going to be here. Let's just let it go." So what happened was Mr. Buning approached the judge to make sure that the numbers were the same, that we were talking about sort of the same, the number
that... So the judge didn't try and call the number?
No. What happened was the phone rang in the middle of that hearing. Right. The judge picked up the phone. The person would not identify themselves.
Understand.
And that's how we realized that the witness had then called the juror's phone, because now the numbers sort of matched up. Because when you look at
the... What is the legal standard that the court should apply when a juror has an exposure like this after having been seated? Why not remove the juror? And if so, under what standard? Because the jury's been sworn, the defense has the right to keep the juror. So what's the legal standard? How would you articulate that? I understand we review for abuse of discretion, but...
Yes, that's what I was just going to say, an abuse
but what
of discretion.
But what standard does the district court apply?
Well, that's...
I don't have time for her to answer this, Chief.
Oh, yes, of course.
I don't know how to answer that question. I mean, I think one of the things that the judge has to do, because the judge is sitting there, the judge sees the demeanor and the way the person is answering, the judge understands that while this trial was supposed to take 2 weeks and we had told the jury it was going to take 2 weeks, it bled into a third week. At that point, everybody was sort of tired and frustrated because of the length of it. But I think the jurors at that point, if you read through the record, they understood the importance of what was going on.
I'm talking about a mistrial. Yeah. I'm talking about whether or not to let this juror go and have
I think you just got to talk to the juror, and the district court has to sort of make that determination.
To determine what? Whether there's bias at this point? Whether it infected the juror's impartiality? What?
Yeah.
Okay.
We want to dispute that the act itself is an act of misconduct.
The mother going up and asking...
The jurors.
The juror's communication with someone who is...
But the juror never communicated with the person on the phone.
The juror communicated with the mother.
Oh, yes.
And overheard the phone call.
Yes.
And knew that the call was related to the solicitation of a witness for at least one side or the other.
Yes.
That ex parte communication, that communication is an act of misconduct under our instructions for a juror.
Yes, it is.
So the question then is, what steps should the judge take to rehabilitate the juror, if at all, and continue that jury in the trial?
I think that the judge then has to canvass the juror and see if they are biased or impartial. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question correctly. This jury was on the opposite side of where the courtroom was. We were in courtroom D, and they were instructed to always go down to A and B. I think maybe there needs to be a different standard when a defense person, in this case, you know, it's difficult because it's not like that juror reached out to this person.
Nonetheless, the duty was to rebuff. I mean, and that's the point. It is a misconduct analysis, I think.
True.
And as to juror number 12, there seems to be some confusion about what happened there. But as I understand it, the judge canvassed juror 12 and four other jurors who apparently heard about this contempt allegation. Is that correct?
Yes. I guess I hesitated because the juror never used the word contempt. I think we understood that it was a contempt, but the juror just knew that juror number 12 knew that somebody had been fined. Didn't know the amount, but knew that somebody had been fined. And he surmised that it was, I don't know her juror number now, but Willie Smith, the lady who had the outburst in the courtroom and then left because he never saw her after that day.
But the thrust of my question is, why did the judge interview four other jurors about whether a prior juror had been held in contempt.
My understanding of what the court did was the court was trying to determine whether juror number 12, because juror number 12 had mentioned that they had talked to other people. So those other people were brought in to know, what did juror number 12 say to you in regard to what happened at this bar?
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. All right. Mr. Faber, you have 5 minutes.
5 minutes?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Piper.
And thank you, Chief Justice, for the additional time. There are a couple of things, and why don't we just start with what we just left with, and I can move back a little bit with regard to the juror misconduct. Justice Pickering and Justice Hardesty, you both asked about what standard is appropriate for the district court's inquiry, and I would direct the court to the case that we cited, Rover v. State, which is at 111 Nevada 1052. There needs to be sufficient inquiry by the district court with regard to whether there's any certainty that the conduct had any kind of potential impact on the verdict, but also another determination, and that determination is beyond a reasonable doubt that there was no prejudice. And certainly the case can be made for prejudice. The mere canvassing, can you still be fair and impartial, comes nowhere near to that type of analysis that needs to be done. What is devoid from this record is the district court making any of the appropriate inquiries, but more importantly, any of the appropriate findings for this court to review. Rover indicated that those type of determinations need to be made. Now, the prejudice, I think, to the court should be somewhat evident that he is overhearing, as stated, the struggle, and he knew it was a defense witness. He testified to that during the canvas, that there was some reluctancy, hesitancy, whatever you want to call it, but that the mother was pounding that you need to be here now and was getting loud and that everybody was hearing this. That was prior to that witness showing up and testifying as our alibi witness. The prejudice is evident that this person, to that juror, hearing information outside the record, that they didn't want to be there or maybe were reluctant to testify, which had to weigh, and you cannot say with any degree of certainty, that they didn't have some impact on the verdict, and you certainly can't say beyond a reasonable doubt that there was no prejudice. With regard to juror number 12, didn't bring it to the court's attention. It was juror number 2 who brought to the court's attention that juror 12 is out there talking about the case and telling us stuff that he overheard something in an elevator that is going to cause him to have bias, at least in her opinion. That was never accorded. The court didn't make the inquiries, and certainly the court, it was incumbent upon the court to make those inquiries, and the defense was asking, look, this is too much, it's happening. And it's not in a vacuum. It's all happening from Millie Smith throughout through these constant interruptions by the jury with very bizarre inquiries. So juror number 12 says, I was in the bar, they came up to me, they told me about a juror being fined. I knew it was the woman who in front of all of us said she couldn't be fair and impartial and then disappeared. Juror number 2 said, oh no, he was talking about overhearing something he shouldn't have overheard in the elevator. Juror number 8 then comes in, she said, yeah, I heard him say that he had heard something that he shouldn't have heard. And then the court doesn't do any further inquiry. We've got the entire jury panel involved in this discussion out in the hallway. And the court not only doesn't follow what it's supposed to do to make a record, she denies the relief that we requested. So that's what was going on with the jury issues, and that doesn't even talk about really juror number 1 and the misconduct which is conceded. Justice Gibbons, you did ask about the severance issue, and yes, it's true. We were repeatedly under Chartier asking for severance as different things came up. I would also say, though, that if we look at the motion for a new trial, Mr. Coulter had waived his Fifth Amendment rights. He had confessed in open court. He said he had done this. It was in no uncertain terms. He would be available upon a retrial to be able to testify. And certainly, I think Your Honor appreciates the difference between being in a trial and invoking your Fifth Amendment right, then having severed trials and doing the same thing that ultimately Mr. Coulter did, which was to spill his guts and do a very detailed confession, which upon a retrial certainly would be an extraordinarily impactful.
Mr. Figgling, in relation to the time this affidavit was prepared and signed by Mr. Coulter, how much time elapsed from that and the start of the trial where, you know, potentially this affidavit could have been used and would become a severance issue? Was there a long lapse of time or what?
I'm sorry, I don't understand. Between
he signed this affidavit.
In 2006.
Okay, well, they're being tried together, so I think potentially, I think each side could see that there might be a potential severance issue there.
We discussed that amongst the defense team, and we just didn't know if we had the grounds, and certainly the co-defendant would have had the grounds because it implicated him. I mean, it would be hard to say, and I think if the court does review the letter and the affidavit, you'll see that in the hundreds and thousands of cases that you've all seen, there's far less admissions or inculpatory admissions that have resulted in someone being arrested and convicted. I mean, certainly he is putting himself with the getaway car and the car that went to the scene that contained all the items. And that coordinates with a lot of the stuff that was later found, his DNA, the co-defendant's DNA on that gun, et cetera. So there are ample reasons why that was powerful defense evidence. Justice Perregaard pointed out some of it, but there was even more. There was even more.
And again, I guess that's what I want to hear from you is as far as the admissibility of the affidavit and letter. Counsel indicated to us that really there was nothing that implicated the defendant, there was nothing against his penal interest that would allow it to be admissible.
And certainly there are absolutely reasonable and understandable inferences that a jury would have made and that the court should have made had it conducted a reasonable hearing at a reasonable time that he was implicating himself in that murder. When he was with the car at the scene, and I appreciate they say it doesn't give specific addresses, but you couldn't reasonably and with a straight face argue to anyone that he wasn't talking about this instance. The dates absolutely match up. The times of the morning when he took the car to when he returned the car, when he met Mr. Ross and then went off, it's all corroborated. It couldn't have been any other event but this event. And he essentially implicated himself as being in control of not just the getaway car, but the instruments of the murder. The things that were found, the shards of glove, the gun that was the murder weapon. I mean, there's no reasonable argument and there's no ability to diminish the reasonable inferences that he was putting himself at the scene with the stuff and with intimate knowledge of it. And that really is all that's necessary for penal interest. He doesn't have to say, and by the way, I killed that guy. That would be an unreasonable expectation. Certainly none of the case law supports that.
Any other questions? All right, counsel, thank you for your arguments and briefs. The case will stand submitted and the court will be in recess.